Thanks. I'll do my best. Yes, I was asked to give an overview of the use of tensor networks in Internet's meta theory. This is actually part of two talks, the second one by Glenn and Lee on Friday morning, I guess. And so we split it up basically into the two broad classes of tensor networks, which are kind of patch and MPS, and then everything that. So these are kind of the tensor networks where the tensors get associated directly with the sites of the letters, and then the ones that have some kind of sense of RG direction, like tree tensor networks and MeLa, which Glenn will talk about on Friday. For this talk, I'm going to assume some familiarity with the tensor networks, so I'm not going to review the basic language of tensor networks. If that's a false assumption, stop me, and I'll try to give more elementary background. Also, please do stop me if I'm using jargon, which I inevitably will, and just call me out on it, and I'll try to explain it. And then, as I was preparing this, I realized that, you know, this is still an incredibly broad field. Tensor networks in quantum matter has grown in the last 10 or 15 years into a, you know, very broad field with lots of directions. So my selection of topics is you know, certainly very biased by my interests. I'm going to try and give a little bit of a start with kind of a broader overview. What is a patch and an MPS? What are the kind of broad questions that in Internet we would like to answer using tensor networks, and why would that seem to be a good idea? And this is sort of the very broad part, and then I'm going to get a little more specific and talk about some more specialized topics. I'm not sure if we'll get to all of this. That depends on how many questions there are. And I certainly don't think I was planning to actually get to all of this. And the selection of these specific topics are, you know, that's probably my personal choice, sort of inspired by my personal interest. But if, you know, if there's topics that I should emphasize that you're more interested in, I'll be happy to discuss that. If there's things that are not interesting to this audience, let me know and I'll proceed more quickly to them. In general, please interrupt me. I hope that this is somewhat interactive, and you know, give me some guidance on what the interests are for you, and then I'll try to spend more time on that. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say. As kind of disclaimers in the beginning. So what is a PEPS? Actually, PEPS, what does it stand for? It stands for Projected Entangled Pair States, which is sort of a historical name. I'm not actually going to explain why it's called that. Let's just pick up the name. At the time when people first started thinking of this, there was a natural name. At this point, looking back, it may not be the most natural name to call it. So what's the system we're looking at? So we're looking at a lattice model. And throughout this entire talk, I'm only going to talk about lattice models. People are looking into extending these ideas to continuum models, but that's a very recent direction, very incomplete at this point, and I'm not going to have the time to go into that. So imagine some lattice, and most of the time I'm just going to draw a square lattice and have the physical size live on the vertices of my square lattice. And then the patch basically just means that I have one tensor per lattice size. So the picture we draw something like this. So we have a square grid, and on each side of this square grid, we place what we would call a rank 5 tensor. And so it has 4 legs connecting it to its nearest neighbors on the lattice and 1 physical leg. We call this rank 5 in the tensor network community. It's a maybe unfortunate name because it has nothing to do with the matrix rank. that you would, you know, learn in undergraduate linear algebra. But that's historically the name that we've gotten this. So when we say a rank 5 tensor, we just mean it has 5 legs. The rank in terms of matrix rank can be anything. If you construct such a PEPS on a 1D system on a chain, you get a very familiar looking picture. You'd get something like this. So now on, you know, on a chain, a side only has 2 nearest neighbors, so I have 2 auxiliary legs going to the nearest neighbors and 1 physical leg, and this is of course a matrix product state, which I'm assuming most people are on some level familiar with. Matrix product states are of course historically the first tensor network state. They form the basis of the DMRG algorithm due to White in 1992. This far predates any thinking about tensor networks. When Steve White originally thought of the DMRG algorithm, it wasn't phrased in the language of matrix product states. And it took a couple of years for people to realize that DMRG is just a variational algorithm over these matrix product states. So in the mid-90s, I think in 1995, Ostlund and Romer realized that DMRG operates over such matrix product states. And that was maybe the starting point, historically, of the field of tensor networks.
Is there a physical system we could be thinking of to sort of guide our intuition?
Think of spins for now. Yeah. Say, spin 1/2 on the square lattice. Mm-hmm. Most of this talk, I'm going to focus on bosonic or spin systems, but I'll mention at some point what you need to do if you want to do this for fermions. So what is the history of extending this matrix product state idea to 2 dimensions and making it into a PEPS? The names that probably come into mind foremost is Verstrada and Sivak. In 2004. This was certainly the paper that popularized the idea. It turns out that the idea of extending matrix product states to 2 dimensions in this way is actually much older. There's a paper by Sierra and Martin Delgado which in 1998 first mentioned this idea. It's kind of mentioned in the conclusions of that paper. And then a group in Japan, Ron Tomotoshi Nishino, and various collaborators expanded this idea and worked out a lot of the numerical details, worked out a lot of the algorithms, which unfortunately went largely unnoticed in the community for many years. And so basically from 1998 to 2004, a lot of the numerical algorithms and a lot of the ideas around PEPS were developed by this group. All of this is in like the Slovenian Journal of Physics. Nobody ever noticed these papers until Frank and Ignacio had similar ideas in 2004. And then people went back and realized that a lot of this was already in the literature. Often this was realized in hindsight. People would develop a new algorithm, look back at the pictures in Nishino's papers and realize that Nishino knew it in 2001, but nobody ever read the paper.
What about Penrose in 1968, 1970?
Right. So there's an earlier history. Actually, so the first mention of a matrix product state is actually by Heisenberg in 1932 or something like that, who mentions in some paper on the Heisenberg chain that a good ansatz for the Heisenberg chain would be to take a product of matrices. Actually, if you look, Tomotoshi has a website where he discusses kind of the early history. Baxter had a lot of these ideas for statistical mechanics models. So I guess this is the history of using these as thinking of these as variational states for 2 plus 1 dimensional lattice quantum systems. In 2 and 3D STATMAX systems, this goes back much longer. But the ideas were never really fleshed out until the work of Nishino, I think. If you look at this literature, this doesn't always go under the name of PEPS. So there's a number of other names. In part of the literature, this gets called a tensor product state. Nishino has various different names in various papers. I think the most common one is tensor product variational ansatz. All of these are the same thing. All of these are basically characterized by having one tensor per physical site that has legs connecting to its nearest neighbors on the lattice. I'm going to call that a PEPS. Other people call it different names, but they're all basically equivalent ANSATZ states. What differs are the ways that you deal with them numerically, and I'll say more about that later.
And remind me, what do the letters in PEPS stand for again?
Projected entangled pair states. Maybe if you have time at the end, I can explain where that name comes from. What are some of the kind of elementary features that you need to know? Maybe let me just mention two. So the most important number about these is what we call the bond dimension. I'm going to call the bond dimension M. Other people call it little d, uppercase d, and so on. It'll be M throughout this talk. That's the number of values that this index runs over. Right? So you think of this as an M by M by M by M by D tensor. D is the number of sites in your local Hilbert space. So if you have spin 1/2, D is 2. Okay. And then M is basically the refinement parameter of the ANSATZ. And so if you take M to infinity, you basically span the full Hilbert space. So this all becomes exact, but also becomes completely impractical in the limit of M to infinity. The entanglement in a PEPS naturally follows an area law. So you can upper bound the entanglement of some region by cutting out the region. I'm sure this is extremely familiar to this audience, but let me say it anyway. And basically counting the legs that stick out. That's a trivial upper bound on the entropy. And so you naturally have an area law. The coefficient of that area law is related to the log of the bond dimension M. So that's basically the way that M is a refinement parameter. Right? So this is a low entanglement approximation to your quantum state. For M equals 1, this captures product states. For M equals infinity, it captures the full Hilbert space. And in between, it captures the set of states that have entanglement, area law entanglement with a coefficient not larger than log n. Okay.
So actually, can I ask you just a sociological question?
Yeah.
I guess, right, so there, this idea sort of is very nice abstractly, but I mean, were people already here, I mean, was this actually being used like to actually compute stuff?
Good question. Brings me basically to my next point. It was, and let me get there. So what do we do with this? What do CM theorists do with it? And let me broadly categorize the questions we want to answer into two classes. One is where we're given a Hamiltonian, and one is where we're not given a Hamiltonian. And this probably sounds like I'm introducing all of condensed matter physics. But say we're given a Hamiltonian, and you can think of this as a sum of local terms. So H, L are some terms that act on some small region on the lattice. Then there's really three problems we want to solve. One is the variational problem. So find the lowest energy eigenstate of H. The next one would be to solve the dynamics. So basically, given some initial state, calculate this. And finally, thermodynamics. So calculate trace of, say, in the canonical ensemble, O being some operator. And in principle, all of these three problems can be attacked numerically using tensor network states. So let me first maybe mention in the case of MPS. So in the case of MPS, all three of these can be done and are being done in practice frequently and with great success. The variational problem is the oldest one. So this is the DMRG algorithm due to White in 1992. And still today, even though we understand much better why the algorithm works, we're still essentially running the same algorithm. It turns out to be, in practice, the optimal way of finding the ground state in terms of a matrix product state. Dynamics was solved around 2004, simultaneously by Vidal and by White, and is also done frequently and with great success.
What do you mean by dynamics?
Real-time evolution.
So calculating expectation values of real-time evolved states,
yes,
under local automaton.
Yes, yes, yes.
Don't you have an entanglement growth problem?
Yes, you do. Well, it depends on the setup, right? So if, say, you start in the ground state and you do a local quench, then you don't, and then you can go to very long times. If you do a global quench, you do have an entanglement growth problem, and the time you can go to is limited. It's exponentially hard to grow the time. Still, NPS is drastically better than any other numerical method that we have for calculating time evolution of 1D quantum systems. So it's exponentially hard in time in the general case, but it's still drastically better than anything else.
That it's hard because you're evolving in real time, so
yeah,
there's,
yeah,
lots of cancellation.
Because entanglement grows linearly in time in general, yeah.
When you say it was solved with
an algorithm, an efficient algorithm, so an algorithm that's polynomial in the bond dimension was found. And then thermodynamics, this is also known how to do, and is also done frequently in matrix polystates. Now for PEPs, the situation is a little bit different. The variational problem, we have ways to do it. So I'm going to put a check mark here. There's caveats. The ways we have to do this aren't nearly as good as the ways we have to do this. The reason is...
About 2D?
2D, yeah, yeah. So when I say PEPs, I mean 2D. So here I'm talking about 1D, and here I'm talking about 2D. So in 1D, we have this beautiful DMRG algorithm, which has a very low scaling and in practice turns out to converge in almost all reasonable cases. In 2D, we don't have that. And I'm going to explain why that's a much harder problem in 2D. But still, this can be done and is being done successfully for, you know, relevant physical problems, but not nearly as widely spread as matrix product states. Dynamics, let me put a check mark in parentheses. We know how to do it in principle. In practice, I don't think this has been successfully applied to any interesting problem. Thermodynamics, similarly, we know sort of in principle how to do this, but in practice, I don't think this has ever been done.
So for example, like say the 2D Ising model in a transverse field, how good are the checks for that?
That's a pretty good check here. That's a good example because it's, of course, the example that everybody does. And so we know that, you know, in the phases, PEPs is going to work extremely well. Of course, if you're far away from the phase transition, the entanglement is very low. The classical description is very good. If you try to extract the critical point, you'll get a fairly good number. The exact critical field is like, what is it, 3.04. If you run PEPs, you get 08, 09, I don't know. You're within a few percent on the critical point in this case. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the best case because, you know, it has very low entanglement even at the critical point. If you take more complicated critical theories, you'll be further away. So let me say you get, so this is what we know from quantum Monte Carlo. With PEPs, it'll be a few percent off, but not like terribly.
So to quantify your parentheses there, could you say a little bit more about what's the difference between we know how to do it in principle and no one's done it in practice? I mean, what kind of resources do you think it would take to do it successfully in practice? For example, if you had a collaboration the size of these lattice gauge theory collaborations and supercomputers of their size have been running for the past 10 years, you know, could you do this for a subsystem or is part of that?
Let me do the following. Let me explain why this is such a much harder problem. And then maybe it'll become clear. And also, that'll explain why I'm hesitant about saying that we can solve this if we just throw manpower or computing power at it.
the question of computing local observables, perhaps?
Yeah, I'm.
Is that in dynamics, or?
I've swept that under the rug for now, but I was going to get to that right now. So let me maybe do the following. So say you wanted to do this. So the problem we're trying to do is we're trying to solve this minimization problem. The first step that you need to do is you need to calculate this. Right? That's exactly the point. So how do we calculate this? Let me first write this in the case of matrix product states. So you have a matrix product state. Then you apply an operator. Let me just apply a local operator, one of my HLs. So I need to contract a network that looks like this. Right? This summing over all of the indices here is going to give me this expectation value. In the case of matrix product states, you can convince yourself that you can do this in order m cubed times L. Basically, you would just start at a corner here and, you know, contract these two together, then contract this one, and so on. You just proceed, and you get m cubed times L. So you do this in polynomial time. And the power here being pretty low means that you can take n to, in practice, easily 10,000. Now let's do this for PEPs. For PEPs, this is a little harder to draw. I'm going to make a mess here. Let me get two colors. So just for simplicity, this is actually just the network for the norm, which is sort of the, you'd think, the easiest operator to calculate. So I've just taken Brian, Cat together and contracted over all the physical indices. It turns out that doing this is sharp P hard. So it's as hard as counting the number of solutions to an NP hard problem, which means you can't do this exactly in practice. It's sort of easy to see, right? So if you look at this contraction, you can start somewhere and the number of legs on your tensor doesn't grow. You know, you put you start putting these tensors together, you never get an object that has more than three legs. If you start doing this here, you'll get bigger and bigger objects, so you'll run out of memory very, very quickly. So we cannot exactly contract the PEPs in the general case. It's actually fairly easy to show why this is true. Maybe I'll do it at the end. There's a lot of grounds I want to cover. So this is the fundamental problem why all of these are so much harder than in the case of MPS. So basically, once you've solved this, you know, you can calculate this, and then you can leverage being able to calculate all these things efficiently into algorithms to do, you know, variation optimization, dynamics, and so on. In the PEPS case, we're basically failing at step one. We don't even know how to exactly calculate an expectation value. Why are there any check marks here? That's because we have approximate algorithms to do these contractions. And there's kind of a zoo of such algorithms, you know, for open systems, for infinite systems, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to discuss the details, but they all suffer from two problems. They all have, even in the approximation, very bad scaling. So the scaling is roughly something like m to the 12. Maybe some algorithms are m to the 10. But it's really, really, really bad. It means that your bond dimension, you can maybe push to 10, maybe 15, but nowhere close to what you can do in matrix product states. And the other problem is all of these have stability issues. None of these are numerically, you know, sort of good, well-behaved algorithms. They will just sit down, you'll program them, and they'll run. DMRG is like that. DMRG, you can just sit down, you look at Steve White's paper, you program what he says, it works. These things take an enormous amount of fiddling. And that's the main reason why these are in question marks. So for the variation problem, we can kind of fiddle these to work. For time evolution, It tends to be more unstable. You know, accumulation of errors and so on is a much worse problem here than here. And so controlling these things, I think, prevents us from really putting a check mark here without parentheses, and the same here. And so basically stability is sort of limiting the range of problems we can apply this to, and the scaling is limiting how practically useful it is, because, you know, if you want to solve some challenging problem, you have large entropy, you need large bond dimension, you run out of steam.
Can you say, for example, again, like how, if you do thermodynamics, how it compares with quantum Monte Carlo? Like, if you're just trying to do it in terms of recycling?
That's never been done in 2D. So this is really, we would in principle know, you know, you could purify and do imaginary time evolution, and that's an algorithm. In principle, nobody's ever run this, so I don't think there's any experience on how it would compare to quantum Monte Carlo.
In terms of all those check marks, do you know much about how quantum algorithms would run?
Quantum algorithms just...
So, for example, approximating contraction just kinds of numbers in this geometry. Is that a field for instance?
Yeah, it has been.
Dynamics would be easy, right?
So this is a problem that is contained for quantum computation. This is a paper by Zalando and Tara. That they show that quantum computers can contract tether networks.
Well,
up to additive errors.
So I would be surprised if you can. So you certainly can't solve the contraction problem on a quantum computer?
Not exactly.
But
if you go to this additive error, that would be very useful.
Yeah.
Maybe.
You don't
Maybe.
Need to, right? Can't you just evolve with the. Can you simulate the Hamiltonian evolution efficiently?
Well, you could forego the tensor network approximation and do it exactly.
Yeah.
if you want to stay within, like,
I mean, you could prepare the state. You could take the state prepared by the tensor network and then evolve it by
trying. Yes. Yes. So that can be done.
There's something that confused me in this picture. We know that these local H's in one dimension. They don't encode any hard problems, but in two dimensions you already have NP completeness. Classically, I mean, even if the H is just complete.
So let me.
So you somehow can't avoid this NP completeness here.
No, I'm not sure. So let me say the two open questions here. So I think one open question is: are there better approximate schemes? The other open question is this Sharpe hardness kind of a red herring? Because this is, you get this for PEPs that encode classical partition functions, right? So you can basically contract, like you can encode solving free set into calculating the norm of a tensor network. That's how you show that this is Sharpe hard. No local quantum Hamiltonian is going to have free set as its ground state. So are there subclasses? I'm not saying that as a theorem, but if I take the Heisenberg model on the Kagami lattice, the ground state is not going to be, you know, some hard stat mac problem.
You can encode the NP hard problems into local Hamiltonians.
Yeah. But I guess so one question that you might ask is, are there subclasses of PEPs that don't suffer from this problem of being hard to contract, but still capture the physics of the ground states we have in kind of the problems that come up in condensed matter theory? And I think the answer to that may be yes. You know, there may be
instances of the problem are not typically what the condensed matter physicist is in.
Exactly. So are there, and can we somehow find systematic subclasses of PEPs that don't suffer from this hardness problem but are useful in practice in condensed matter? I think that's an open question. There's been some work on that, but I don't think there's really been kind of a great answer to that question yet. And so that this whole question of Sharpe hardness may or may not be sort of a red herring for practical calculations in condensed matter problems.
You said that there are approximate schemes with these issues. Have you said in what sense they're approximation? I mean, what kind of control parameter controls how good the approximation is?
So let me... yeah.
So basically, these schemes all, in some sense, work by iteratively contracting the network and approximating the objects that you get by contracting a few tensors together by themselves tensor networks again. So you could think of contracting this by thinking of the columns of this as operators that map you, you know, like a transfer matrix calculation. And then you solve for the eigenvector of that transfer matrix problem. And that eigenvector you itself write as a tensor network. So you basically run DMRG on a PEPS. So it's kind of a dimensional reduction
thing. They work in the approximation that the entanglement between rows is small.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And that seems to be a very reasonable thing for many ground states of kind of the systems we encounter in practice. So these algorithms certainly work fairly well for byte classes of systems. But I don't think there's any, you know, there's any proofs that they work in any case, but there's empirical evidence that they work reasonably well. Okay, let me go back and talk about the other kind of broad class of problems that we would want to study using tensor networks. And this is sort of beyond Hamiltonian. Let me not call it beyond Hamiltonians. But let me write down the two questions that you could study. So one question is what phases of matter exist? And how are they distinguished? So this kind of foremost comes up in topological phases, right? Until the 80s, we thought that local symmetry breaking describes all phases of matter. Then we learned that there's diffraction quantum Hall effect. And in the late 80s, early 90s, we learned that there's, you know, RVB phases that have spin liquid and topological physics. Then in the early 2000s, we learned that there's topological insulators and symmetry protected topological phases. Now we're learning that there's, you can put the two together and there's symmetry enriched topological phases. And the zoo of possible phases in condensed matter is growing, basically, you know, every couple of years. And you could ask whether PEPs are a good tool to study these questions. And this is closely, so these questions are really closely related, because to say what phases of matter, you know, exist, you must sort of say how they're distinguished from phases of matter we already know. And then you could ask, are PEPs a useful tool for distinguishing these phases? Because, you know, as we go along, they're distinguished by more and more subtle features. You know, they're not distinguished by local order parameters anymore, but say by the bulk excitations and the degeneracy for topological phases. And then for SPT phases, they're, you know, distinguished in very subtle ways by the action of the symmetry on the entanglement spectrum. And that's where tensor networks are starting to look like an extremely natural tool. And then, you know, if SET phases where all of these things come together, and more it seems that PEPs are a natural language to work in for describing these more and more exotic phases. And so some more concrete questions that you could ask is you could attempt explicit constructions. So I think for a lot of these phases that have been discovered in like the last decade or so, the only compact way to write the wave functions are in terms of tensor product states. And so explicitly constructing examples in that language is very useful. It allows you to compute properties. So a lot of these exotic phases are distinguished, you know, not by things that have a simple operational meaning, not local operator or something like that, but entanglement properties, features in the entanglement spectrum, and so on, which are very natural in the language of tensor network states and very unnatural in other ways of attacking the problem. You could try to classify the possible phases of matter. This has been a very successful agenda, actually, in 1D. So in 1D, you know that the gap phases of matter are basically in correspondence to matrix product states. And so you can classify phases by classifying matrix product states. And so the first classification of 1D SPT phases was actually obtained in a language of MPS. And one agenda right now is to kind of carry out the same thing in 2D and try to classify all the possible 2D PEPs and maybe by that obtain a classification of 2D phases.
Can you say a little more about the classification of the 1D phases?
I was hoping to avoid going into too much detail on that.
Okay.
we can talk about it. I'd be happy to talk about it later. Right. Okay, so this is sort of this. So where these questions are really numerically focused, these are sort of the analytical questions, more conceptual questions where PEPs are kind of emerging as a useful tool for analytical studies rather than numerical studies. And so that's circumventing a lot of the problems that we have in the numerics.
So you mentioned that this confection of PEPs is sharply hard. Doesn't that tell you that classification of phases in 2D, I mean, you'd expect that to be something too rich in order to really be able to classify everything?
Oh, you mean that the 2D PEPs could be too large of a class of states? Yeah. That may certainly be true, yeah. I think that's something that people are just starting to look at, and it's really not clear where that is going and if that's going anywhere.
Aren't there phases that are it's uncomputable whether they're gapped or not?
Okay. It's asking whether any of these questions are actually reasonable questions to ask, I guess. So the next thing I wanted to discuss is why would PEPs be a good idea for this? PEPs or MPS? And we could spend a lot of time philosophizing about this. Let me give two arguments. So one is the experience from 1D. So we know that MPS work well. And we know this both empirically. So we know this from the success of the DMIG method in practice. But we also have rigorous statements about this. This is due to Hastings, who showed that the ground states of 1D gapped local Hamiltonians are, if accurately and efficiently, representable as matrix Pollard states. And actually, by now, we also have provably convergent algorithms for finding MPS. So in 1D, we have a very strong picture that MPS are the right language to describe gap phases of matter. And basically, PEPs being the straightforward generalization to two dimensions, that gives you at least some intuitive idea that PEPs would be, hopefully, a good language to describe 2D phases. Of course, then we run into all these problems of doing these things in practice, and so we really don't, and we don't have any of the rigorous statements that we have in one dimensions, but we certainly have kind of this intuitive argument that PEPs would be a good description of 2D phases. Let me give another argument, namely that many fixed point wave functions are PEPs. So what do I mean by this? So you could imagine that you're trying to study some phase diagram. You have a bunch of phases, is A, B, C, D. And for a lot of phases, we know that they contain a fixed point somewhere in here, which has an exact representation as a PEP state of small bond dimension. This is clearly the case for kind of simple symmetry breaking states. So if you have like an anti-ferromagnet or ferromagnet, there's a classical limit, which is described by a PEP of bond dimension 1. But we also know this for a lot of more exotic states. So for example, for kind of very broad classes of topological phases, we know that they have exact descriptions as PEPs of small bond dimension. there are certain gapless systems or power law correlated systems where we know that they have an exact PEPS representation. And so if you're studying a phase diagram where all of the phases you're interested in at least have one point in the phase that has an exact description as a small point dimension PEPS, you would hope that you can go stray away from this point a little bit here and still have a reasonable description as a PEPS. Maybe this is going to break down at the phase transition, but at least in the phases, somewhere you have points where PEPS are a good way to represent your states. One trivial example for this is just the easing model in transverse field. So we have a phase diagram as a function of some transverse magnetic field, some critical point. Over here, we have a ferromagnet. So the cartoon for the state is this, which is the classical state. So in the limit where the magnetic field is zero, we trivially have a PEPS description. Over here, we have the paramagnet. Again, has a trivial PEPS representation of point dimension one. And empirically, we know that actually the description works really well throughout this entire phase diagram, except very close to the critical point where the entropy gets too large.
You used the word fixed point. Is the RG flow really well defined in this context? I mean, I agree with that there are in these phases often wave functions that have a concise description, but you call them fixed points, implying there was an RG flow.
So these are fixed points in the sense of having zero correlation length, mostly. Except,
I mean, sometimes, for instance, in Wen's papers, that diagram you drew would have little arrows indicating the flow. Is that mythological, or is that real?
That depends, I think, on the phase that you're looking at. I'm not going to claim that you can always define an RG, that you can really turn this into an RG phase diagram. In many cases, you would be able to.
Is that exactly solvable on this study?
Yes, I could, certainly, yeah. Okay, how are we doing on time? So maybe with that, I'm basically done with the first half. but I'll keep it very brief in the second part and just mention a few interesting aspects.
So I had a question before we move
on. Oh, yeah.
What's the connection between gap systems and single layer tensor networks, like as opposed to something like Mira, which has multiple layers?
I would say that if you have a gap system, if your correlations are exponentially decaying, all of the physics is essentially local, and so kind of a flat description like you have in PEPS and MPS seems sufficient to capture all of the properties, because there are no kind of long-range correlation functions that you need to capture, except if you're in a topological phase, which has kind of very particular long-range features, which we know can be captured also in PEPS and MPS. And if you have a critical system with power law correlations, the physics is not essentially captured in kind of local things anymore. And so then it seems that you would need some, you guys are the people who should know this. But you need some kind of holographic direction to capture, some kind of RG direction to capture those long-range correlations. So in that language, you know, in that approach, it seems more natural to describe short-range correlated things or topological things in the language of a flat network and things that have power law correlations in some kind of hierarchical network. But that's, of course, a kind of very coarse picture. I'm not sure there's more precise things that can be said. Does that answer your question to some extent? Okay. So one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit, but I put this in parentheses because it's sort of separate from a lot of the other topics, is fermions. So how do we describe fermions using MPS or PEPS in particular? Let me first just very briefly mention why this is an interesting question. So in 1D, this is sort of trivial. You have a you can do a John-Wigner transformation. So you replace, say, C dagger, which creates a fermion on side I, by some John-Wigner string times spin operator. And now you can carry out this John-Wigner transformation, and any local 1D Hamiltonian will end up being a local spin Hamiltonian, at least for open boundary conditions. In 2D, you could imagine doing the same thing. So say we have a system of 9 sides. To do this John-Wigner transformation, we have to define the ordering here in some ways. So we just pick one. So this is 1, 2, 3, and so on. And now if you take, say, a fermion hopping term from here to here, and you apply this John-Wigner transformation, you're going to get a local spin term. But if you take, say, a hopping term from here to here, you apply the John-Wigner transformation, you're going to get a spin term that involves all the sides between along the John-Wigner strings. So in 2D, this takes a local fermion Hamiltonian to a non-local spin Hamiltonian. So that's bad. And so that you might think at this point that describing fermions in terms of these 2D tensor networks is fundamentally harder than describing bosons. But there's a very, to me, maybe surprising result, which shows that that's actually not the case, and that there's a way to do fermions in tensor networks at essentially the same cost as bosons. The way you do this is you take...
Sorry, why would you thought that fermions were that much harder?
Because...
Nobody's not local?
It's not a particularly deep reason, but if you were to naively map it with a John-Wigner transformation to a boson Hamiltonian, you get a non-local Hamiltonian. So certainly...
So that would be a bad approach.
Right.
But the fermion Hamiltonian is local.
Yeah. The fermion Hamiltonian is local. But it's not obvious that in a numerical algorithm you can take care of the fermionic signs in a way that doesn't increase your computational cost. Certainly the intuition, if you're coming from quantum Monte Carlo, is that fermionic signs are really bad and make your life incredibly hard. And one of the main motivations from a numerical point of view for tensor networks in 2D is that you've solved the fermion sign problem. But if you were to do the first thing and do a John-Wigner transformation, it looks like you get it back because you have these sort of non-local looking signs that you need to keep track of. Maybe that's an intuition that you mostly suffer from if you come from a quantum Monte Carlo background. So the way you solve this problem in tensor networks is to take your tensor and think of your tensor as a fermionic operator itself. So you can think of the tensor as having some Hilbert space associated with each leg. And you could think of sort of the tensor acting as an operator on those. And in everything so far, we've sort of assumed that that's a bosonic operator, so we've kind of swept that notion under the rug and just taken it as a bunch of numbers. But you could think of it as a fermionic operator. So when I draw this picture, you choose some ordering of sites, and you think of this object as a fermionic operator. So this is 10 to the T, some number times my picture is inconsistent with my so what was my notation mean here? So Ci is the fermionic operator living on the ith bond, and then it's raised to the power I, and I'm assuming here that just for simplicity ijk are either 0 or 1. You can generalize this. So now my tensor is not just a bunch of numbers, but it's a fermionic operator acting in the Hilbert spaces living on the auxiliary legs. I'm not going to go through the calculation in the interest of time, But it turns out that you can efficiently keep... So now what happens if you contract your tensor network, you have to take care of the ordering of these thermodynamic operators. And by keeping track of that ordering correctly, you correctly keep track of the thermodynamic signs of your physical operators. It turns out there's an efficient way of doing this, which is to draw your tensor network on a sheet of paper on the plane and identify all the line crossings. So you pick some projection into the plane, and you just identify all of the crossings that you need to take care of to make it a planar graph. And then on those crossings, you insert what's called a swap gate. So you have a crossing like this. You replace that with a tensor. Which is minus 1 if I and j equals 1, and plus 1 otherwise. It's fairly easy to see where this comes from. Basically, if this index is 1, this operator is actually carrying a fermionic mode. So this swap is exchanging two fermionic operators, so you need to take a minus 1. And in all other cases, there's no swapping of fermionic operators, so you just get a plus 1. So you just draw your tensor network, you insert the simple tensor everywhere, and then you proceed as usual. This takes care of all of the fermionic signs and does not introduce any additional leading costs. So you have some signs to take care of, but you can convince yourself that this is always sub-leading compared to other steps of the algorithm. So that's how we do fermions. And then sort of going into the direction of the current conceptual questions that people are asking about PEPs, what phases of matter exist, what phases of matter can be described as a PEPs, and also to tie in some topics that Don asked me to mention, which are how we get edge states from PEPs and what an injective PEPs is. I wanted to discuss what non-trivial states have PEPs representations. And I'll try to keep this brief. What I mean by non-trivial is largely topologically ordered or symmetry protected topological phases. Basically, it means that what states that are not described by some local order parameter have a PEPs representation. Can I assume that everyone is roughly familiar with what a topological phase is? Yes, good. Okay. So the early example that people realize is the toric code. So the toric code is just your ground states are the sum of closed loop configurations. And on the torus, you have four sectors coming from whether you have non-trivial loops wrapping around the directions of the torus. These states turn out to have a PEPs representation as with Bond dimension 2. The PEPs representation is incredibly simple to write down. If there's interest, I can go through the details later, but it's very simple. And so this was realized, I think, in 2004, Frank and Ignacy realized this, which gave them hope that PEPs can describe topological phases, at least in principle. And this was fairly soon generalized to all stringnet models. So you can generalize this. For example, the simplest generalization is that here you would insert minus 1 to the number of loops. This would get you from the toric code to the double Semian theory. This looks like a really non-local property, counting the parity of the number of loops naively. But if you can work out that this has a PEPs representation, the Bond dimension naively is 8. But I think there's probably more compact representations of doing this. And then you can further generalize this to all 11-WAN stringnet models, which in equivalent language are what's called quantum level models. So this is a very broad class of topological phases that are sort of characterized by not having a protected gapless edge state. So these are gapped not only on a closed manifold, but they're also fully gapped if you put them on an open manifold. And so for those, we know that we can explicitly construct PEPS wave functions. These are exactly solvable models that have ground states with zero correlation length, I should add. So they kind of fit into this paradigm of being fixed points or solvable points in some phase. One of the questions that is currently being studied is what about going beyond string nets? The biggest class of topological phases that we know of that you would really like to describe as PEPS are the ones that actually happen in nature, which are fraction quantum Hall states. So fraction quantum Hall states are characterized by having gapless edge states. So you think of a 2D electron gas, apply a magnetic field.
Isn't BCS also an example of a topological phase that happens in nature?
Yes, I would roughly lump those in the same. From the perspective of tensor networks, I think for now we can lump those in the same category. Okay. If you're thinking of like a topological superconductor, like a P plus IP superconductor.
Well, no, or just a conventional superconductor. It has a Z2 gauge theory.
Right. That's true. Those have a PEP circuit. Maybe not in general, but at least there's cases that have a PEP representation, I think.
And is it true for all string models, we actually have better tensor networks like Meras and that are more efficient?
I'm not sure in what sense a Mera would be more efficient than a PEP.
In the sense that you can compute.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Because all of the observables for string net models we already know to start with. But it depends on what you want to know. If you want to calculate, for example, an entanglement spectrum, it's easier in PEPS than in MIRA. But if you want to calculate local observables or correlation functions, which are incredibly boring in this case, but you could, you know, you could perturb the state and want to calculate it, then a MIRA would be a better representation indeed. So fraction quantum Hall states. So what happens for fraction quantum Hall states is that if you have them on a closed system, they're gapped, fully gapped. But if you have an open system, so if you have a boundary, you have a gapless edge. So there's low energy modes that propagate around the system and are localized near the boundary of the system. The additional feature is that in fraction quantum Hall systems, these edges are chiral. So they only move in one direction on the boundary and not the other direction. And one important question that people have asked is whether these states have a PEPS representation. And I think to be quite fair at this point, we don't know the answer to that question. So we know how it's known how to construct a state that has a gapless edge and is topological in some sense. So these are free fermion wave functions. So you can characterize them by the churn number, and they turn out to have a non-trivial churn number. Oh, it means that if you put the system on a geometry with a boundary, it's not fully gapped anymore, but there's low energy modes in the spectrum. The low energy modes are localized on the boundary. That's sort of a single particle notion. In the many-body context, you could probe this by transport or correlation function. So you could calculate, for example, a correlation function in the bulk. This correlation function would decay exponentially with the distance. And if you calculate a correlation function on the boundary, it would decay as a parallel of the distance. That'd be one way to
go. I think I have a question I've never really understood here. Is the question of whether it's a gapless edge system, that is, whether there are gapless nodes when you put in the boundary, is that purely a property of the bulk dynamics, or does it depend to some extent on what boundary condition you impose to the boundary?
That's complicated. So there are certain properties of the edge that are dictated by the bulk, and there are certain properties of the edge that are dictated by a combination of the bulk and the edge. So for example, one property is the chiral central charge of the edge. So let me call that C bar. That's the central charge of the left moving minus the central charge of the right moving sector. That is a quantity that's completely dictated by the bulk. You could also imagine having a central charge. This would not be dictated by the bulk.
To be true, sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Material, you could always imagine putting a thin layer of any other material on its surface, and that would be just as good a boundary as any other boundary you could think of theoretically. So you can never prevent the system from having these...
There's certainly non-trivial edges that you can add.
But these modes produced in that way will cancel with various anomalies, whereas you can guarantee these anomalies.
When there's something like an anomaly, you can guarantee that there are gapless modes.
Yes. And so that guarantees certain properties of the gapless mode, like the chiral central charge. That's one property that's guaranteed.
Okay.
So coming back to these PEPs that we know how to construct have a gapless edge and are topological in some sense. So for example, in this free fermion case, they have a finite Chern number. However, they have power law correlations in the bulk. And now it becomes a question of your definition of chiral phase and topological chiral phase. So you could say that in some sense these are chiral phases, but they're not topological because they're not gapped in the bulk. The correlations in the bulk decay as a power law. Physically, one way to think about these states is that they sit at a phase transition. So you have a phase diagram where on one side you have kind of trivial insulators, and on one side you have a proper topological phase. And it turns out that only at the bottom, so in the trivial phase, as a simple PEPS representation, those are basically product states. And at the boundary, you also have a PEPS representation. And the boundary seems to inherit from this side the fact that it has a PEPS representation, and seems to inherit from this side some of the topological properties, but at the same time is gapless. It's a critical state. So whether you declare victory or not, I think is a matter of language. If you look at the archive, there's two papers that come out at the same time that basically one says no and one says yes. One proves this, one proves that. So now it's up to nomenclature. Another question you could ask is, is the spectrum of parent Hamiltonians for these states gapped? So if you insist on a local parent Hamiltonian, then it's gapless. However, if you're willing to relax that, and if you're willing to take a Hamiltonian that has 1/r³ interactions, then you can find a gapped Hamiltonian. So now, again, it's a question of language. What do you call local? Some people would argue that 1/r³ is sort of sufficiently local for many properties, has a Leib-Robinson bound and so on. So this, whether this question is resolved or not, I think is a question of language.
Sorry, what's the exact statement that for which system you cannot have a local Hamiltonian, which is gapped?
For this particular state that people construct, you cannot have a gapped...
Particular state?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I think in general, you cannot have a gapped parent Hamiltonian, gapped local parent Hamiltonian for a power law correlated state, right? Because a gapped local Hamiltonian implies exponential decay of correlations. Let's see. should I wrap it up now? Or?
Well, I mean, tell me how long you think it would take to cover the rest of what you intended. It's been a nice pace so far.
Okay, I could probably do 10 more minutes.
That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
You're under no obligation at all to finish before 5 after 12.
Okay, okay, yeah. Okay, I'll try and cover this in 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, 10, 15 minutes would be great.
Okay. Let's see, let me not forget too many things here. So another question is SPT phases, symmetry protected topological phases. What is such a phase? So a symmetry protected topological phase is it's a system with a symmetry. So there's some symmetry operator, say, a commutative Hamiltonian. If you're willing to take a path of Hamiltonians that break the symmetry G, then you can adiabatically connect the SPT phase to a trivial phase. However, if you insist on a symmetric path, then you must have a bulk phase transition somewhere along the way. So they're distinguished from trivial phases, from product states, only in the presence of the symmetry. And if you're willing to give up on the symmetry, they just become trivial. Simplest example is being topological insulators and quantum spin halls. So these are actually experimentally observed systems. It turns out that many bosonic SPTs have PEPS representations. And this is maybe one of the cases where PEPS turns out to be an extremely natural language to discuss these systems. So if you look at Chagang Wen's original classification of 2D bosonic SPTs, it's done with a tool set of PEPS, essentially. What PEPS allow you to do is calculate the action. So you can cut the system somewhere, obtain the entanglement spectrum, and calculate the action of the symmetry on that entanglement spectrum, which turns out to be the way to classify these bosonic SPTs, and turns out to be a thing that we can calculate in this language of PEPS very naturally, but not in any other kind of numerical or analytical tool set. One question is, what about fermionic SPTs? I don't think the answer is known. Which classes of fermionic SPTs have a PEPS representation? Even if you take the simplest one, if you take a quantum spin hall, you get by taking two systems with chiral central charge, gluing them together, and preventing interactions between them. So now you run into this problem that separately you can't describe the two systems. Maybe together you can, but I don't think we know explicitly how to do that. And then in studying these SPT systems, PEPS also turn out just to be a very efficient numerical tool. So this is sort of coming to the questions of using PEPS to construct and study exotic states. And this is really because PEPS allow you to extract a lot of properties. So if you have an exact PEPS representation, what's becoming kind of a standard approach now is that you put it on a cylinder, which you can make infinitely long, but with this finite circumference. In this case, it turns out that you can do a lot of computations exactly in cost that's exponential in the width, but basically for free in the length. And then in this, you can calculate correlation functions and bounds. So you can upper bound all of the correlation functions of your system for fixed W. You can calculate entanglement properties. So for example, you can calculate the topological entanglement entropy and things like this. You can calculate the entanglement spectrum, which is kind of becoming our favorite tool for many questions. And this, for example, is something that's very hard to access in other methods. So, you know, correlation functions you could maybe calculate with the Monte Carlo sampling. Entanglement properties, okay, for not many entropies you can calculate in Monte Carlo too. Entanglement spectrum is where it gets difficult. Okay, you could take Monte Carlo, you could try to calculate all Rényi entropies and then try to extract the entanglement spectrum from that. It's numerically ill-defined, extremely challenging. And so if you want the entanglement spectrum, a tensor network approach is extremely natural.
Is it better to use a PEPS than an MPS for the cylinder of fixed width?
So they become more or less equivalent. Conceptually, they're equivalent at that point. In a practical calculation, it may still be useful to exploit kind of the... So you're calculating properties of this transfer operator. This transfer operator in a PEPS has additional structure, which can be useful. So I think conceptually, you can think in terms of MPS at this point, but in practice, using that structure is still going to make your code run a little bit faster.
Same computational cost scaling.
Yeah, leading cost is going to be the same. Because what's limiting now is, if you want to do this exactly, is representing the eigenvector. So that's going to be the same either way. But some things, for example, if you have translational invariants around the cylinder, that's very natural to use if you have a PEPS and sort of goes hiding if you map the PEPS to an MPS. It's still there, but it kind of gets disguised.
What did you mean by entanglement spectrum becoming sort of a commonly used tool in what problems?
Well, okay, so this is tying back to the question of how we actually characterize edge states. So these SPT phases, I should have mentioned that, are kind of in a crucial way characterized by their edge. So how do we access that physics? And it turns out that the simplest way is to look at the entanglement spectrum, which for many of these cases is related to the real edge spectrum. So this allows us to still do all of our computations basically on a closed system. But the entanglement cut seems to be in many ways equivalent to making a real cut of the system. And so by looking at the entanglement spectrum, we can extract properties of the physical edge, which then allow us to infer properties of SPT or topological phases. And so it's in that context where PEPS are really extremely useful.
Can you say more about how you get the entanglement spectrum from this cylinder and for what subregion that is?
So the easiest subregion is if you just cut an infinite cylinder into two semi-infinite cylinders. The way you calculate it is it, so you need to take the transfer operator for a slice of the cylinder, diagonalize that transfer operator, and from the eigenvector you can read it off. It can tell you maybe later how to do it in practice. It's fairly straightforward. But once you've diagonalized that transfer operator, you have the entanglement spectrum.
Okay, but you're getting the spectrum for this subsystem of the cylinder, for this.
Yeah, for a semi-infinite, system. So the trick here, of course, is that because we're using this PEPS representation, the reduced density matrix of the semi-infinite cylinder is, of course, an infinite dimensional object. But because we're working in this PEPS representation, the rank is limited, you know, by the bond dimension to the power of W. And so that's a finite dimensional matrix that's unitarily equivalent to the physical density matrix. So all the spectral properties are hiding in that. And so that's why we can assume we can compute this. And let me maybe mention one. So maybe that's slightly beside the point. Let me just jump to this. So another property that we can extract here is parent Hamiltonians, which sort of leads me into the last topic I wanted to discuss, which is injectivity. So what do I mean by a parent Hamiltonian? So a parent Hamiltonian is just a gapped Hamiltonian whose unique ground state is the PEPS. And it turns out that there's a relation, under some circumstances, there's a relation from the PEPs, so I have a PEPs psi, and from that I can go to the parent Hamiltonian uniquely. The condition to make this possible is called injectivity. What is injectivity? So, imagine you have some very large or possibly infinite translationally invariant PEPs, and take some patch out of that PEPs. This network defines a map, which I'm going to call T sub A. So let's say all of these are tensor A, which maps from the auxiliary degrees of freedom. So the, let me call this here. Maps from the auxiliary degrees of freedom to the physical degrees of freedom. And we call the PEPs injective if this map is injective. And so the surprising result is that if this map is injective for some sufficiently large region, then you can make this connection from the PEPs to the parent Hamiltonian. So it's a fairly powerful statement, and it allows us to do many interesting things. So in particular, if we are studying all these exotic wave functions, which we can write down as PEPs, we may not necessarily know the Hamiltonian that gives rise to these wave functions a priori. And under the right circumstances, this allows us to, you know, write down the state with exotic properties, study the properties, and then write down a local gapped Hamiltonian whose ground state is the PEPs we started from. So it's an interesting connection, sort of the other way than what you would conventionally think of. And then maybe as a final thing to mention is something called G-injectivity. So clearly, this is a condition that you can't require for a topological phase. For a topological phase, there should not be a parent Hamiltonian with a unique ground state on a closed manifold. So there must be some kind of generalized notion of this that applies to topological systems, and that is G injectivity. Here, G is some symmetry. G is some group. G injectivity is two conditions. One condition, and I'm going to draw these as MPS conditions, and it kind of generalizes to PEPs, but it gets painful to draw them, is, so let G be a group element, let UG be a representation of the group, that if you, on the auxiliary legs of the MPS, apply a group element, this is equal to your MPS. This is condition one. Condition two is that this tensor is injective on the invariant subspace. So it's injective in this sense, but only on the subspace of the auxiliary space that is invariant under the group action. And this sort of generalizes the notion of injectivity to topological states. And you can make arguments that this together is a sufficient and necessary condition for PEPs to be topological.
Why isn't your condition one just topological? Because the U and the U diagonal cancel out from adjacent sides.
It applies sort of tensor per tensor. Certainly, if you
different U's at different sites.
No. So it if you were to contract over all legs of the tensor, it's sort of a null condition. It's just that you can always on a bond insert a resolution of the identity. But this equal sign means literally for one tensor. So not the expectation value of the entire network is invariant, but one single tensor is invariant. So it's a stronger condition. So under slightly stronger conditions, it becomes a sufficient and necessary condition for certain types of topological order, namely certain subclasses of the string net models. And so this gives you some glimpse at how you could try to classify topological phases by classifying steps. So you could classify at least some subclass of string net models by classifying G injective PEPs. We know that it's not sort of sufficient for all string net models, but you can generalize this notion. And so here you're acting with the symmetry operators only on individual bonds. You could imagine that you have some tensor network. And instead of inserting these operators, around some region, I'm basically inserting these UGs. These could be themselves more complicated operators. So you can come up with a notion of MPO injectivity, which is allowing sort of more general objects to be applied on the auxiliary level. And one of the directions that are being explored right now is whether this notion of MPO injectivity gives you a complete classification of topological PEPs, and whether that classification, what class of topological phases this corresponds to. Certainly, we know that all string net models are MPO injective, but are there MPO injective phases or MPO injective PEPs that are not string net models? That's one of the open questions that people are currently asking. Maybe I'll leave it at that.
All right. Well, we have lots of questions. Or do we have a final question they'd like to ask?
This theorem of objectivity, does it hold even if the tensors at each site are different from each other?
Yeah.
All right, stay late.